This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, the 3rd of April, 2006. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Thousands of people take to the streets of New Orleans to protest the disenfranchisement of mostly black voters. As sectarian attacks continue in Iraq, we'll hear from Baghdad, where people are calling for Ibrahim Jaafari to rescind his nomination for prime minister. And we'll hear from Berlin, where UN Security Council members consider the future of Iran. We'll bring you these stories and much more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Thailand is still in a political chaos a day and a half after the elections following the dissolution of its parliament. Severine Bardon reports from Bangkok.
Official results are not known yet, but there are already complaints of irregularities, the main one being that the position of the voting booth didn't protect voting secrecy. Opposition parties who asked for a boycott of the poll were happy about the first unofficial results. Participation has been around 60%, which is very low for Thailand, and more than half of the participants chose the no-vote option in Bangkok and in other areas usually supportive of Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat. As a guest on a TV show tonight, the contested prime minister claimed victory for his party. These unconfirmed results still can't hide the fact that the huge proportion of no vote is a real slap in the face for the prime minister. Opposition parties and the People's Alliance for Democracy have been calling for his resignation, something the prime minister doesn't seem willing to do. Further demonstrations are already planned this week, and now that elections have shown their inability to solve the political crisis, everything is possible in Thailand, even the most violent reactions. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Severine Bardon in Bangkok.
French student leaders this weekend called for an unlimited general strike in their battle against the government's youth employment scheme. And on the eve of another day of action, which will see a repeat of last Tuesday's strikes and demonstrations, the governing party has promised to rewrite the legislation within 10 days and asked employers not to sign any of the new style contracts. Tony Cross reports from Paris.
Although the new jobs contract, the CPE, is now law, after President Jacques Chirac endorsed it last Friday, Social Cohesion Minister Jean-Louis Borloo has written to employers' groups asking them not to sign any of the new style contracts. That's after Chirac promised two changes and consultation with the unions who want the law scrapped. Opposition politicians point out that for a public official to prevent legislation from being applied is an offence, punishable by up to 5 years in prison and a hefty fine. Chirac has ordered his party, the UMP, to make the changes and to consult the unions. House Speaker Jean-Louis Debré says he wants the new plan ready within 10 days. A meeting of students from universities involved in the protests this weekend called for an unlimited general strike to get the plan scrapped. Both sides will doubtless be counting the turnout on tomorrow's protests with considerable interest. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
Former Liberian President Charles Taylor made his first appearance before a UN-backed war crimes tribunal today. Samuel Lakoya reports from Lagos.
In his courtroom appearance today, Charles Taylor pled not guilty to multiple counts of war crimes. The former Liberian president also refused to recognize the jurisdiction of the court to try him. Taylor was extradited from Nigeria last week to face trial at the war crimes court in Sierra Leone. The former Liberian president is accused of supporting Sierra Leonean rebels who were responsible for a 10-year civil war. He faces 11 charges, each of which carries a sentence of life imprisonment. In the meantime, the UN Security Council is considering a resolution to move the trial from Sierra Leone to The Hague in the Netherlands for security reasons. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
In Britain today, evidence concealed for 60 years has revealed that the British operated a number of secret detention camps during the Cold War, where suspected communists were routinely tortured during interrogation. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Some men were beaten and starved to death in the camps in Germany after the Second World War. The photographs of prisoners that have been released to the Guardian newspaper under the Freedom of Information Act are disturbing. They show starving men suffering from sleep deprivation, beatings and extreme cold. Female prisoners were also tortured at the camps. According to declassified documents, a government minister just after the war called the camp reminiscent of the German concentration camps. The British government, convinced that a war with the Soviet Union was inevitable, was apparently trying to obtain information about Russian military and intelligence methods. The efforts to declassify the documents on the camps were hampered in various ways by the Ministry of Defence. Documents about another secret interrogation centre operating in central London are still being withheld. The Medical Foundation for the Care of Victims of Torture has called on the government to apologise to the victims and pay compensation. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Over the weekend, thousands of New Yorkers marched across the Brooklyn Bridge in support of immigrants' rights and to protest the passage of the H.R. 4437 bill, currently under debate in the Senate. Luis Perez reports from New York.
An estimated 40,000 people and around 200 civil groups participated in what is now considered the largest rally of its kind so far in the New York area. Yet, this number is rather small in a city with more than 3 million immigrants. Still, organizers are expecting a larger turnout for April 10th nationwide mobilization. Protesters fear that if approved by the U.S. Senate, the bill would further criminalize undocumented immigrants. The march concluded with a rally in Foley Square, where religious leaders, elected officials, and immigration advocates from Latin, African, Asian, and Caribbean groups encouraged unity among ethnic groups and announced the possibility of an immigrant workers' strike to protest the bill. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Luis Perez in New York City.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and her British counterpart Jack Straw made a visit to Baghdad this weekend, where they urged the formation of a new government and for an end to militias. Sectarian attacks and other violence killed more than 50 Iraqis and at least 10 U.S. soldiers over the weekend, and in Baghdad, members of the Shiite alliance that took most of the vote in January's elections called for Ibrahim Jaafari to rescind his nomination for prime minister and end the political gridlock that has, until now, prevented the formation of an Iraqi government. The move indicates increasing tensions between the Shiite parties and a growing resentment towards the U.S., which has criticized Jaafari and is believed to have encouraged the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, a rival Shiite party, to try and unseat him. FSRN's David Enders reports from Baghdad.
U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad denied last week that he delivered a message to rival Shiite leaders saying President Bush does not support Jaafari's candidacy for prime minister. The statement was made at the end of a press conference in which Khalilzad announced the release of journalist Jill Carroll, and the ambassador left without taking questions from reporters.
Some of your outlets have published an article as to how the United States went to talk to Mr. Abdulaziz Hakim, meaning myself, on behalf of the United States, about the issue of the prime minister of Iraq. I want to draw your attention to a statement issued today by Mr. Abdulaziz Hakim's organization with regard to that report.
However, Jawad al-Maliki, Jaafari's deputy in the Dawa Party, remains less than convinced and criticized Khalilzad for his statements. Others have called for the ambassador's removal.
He lied. It is very dangerous if Khalilzad stays here. He endangers the future of our democracy and creates sectarianism. Jaafari must be the prime minister because he was elected under the Constitution. This was the plan laid out by the Americans. If Jaafari is made to go, it'll be very bad for Iraq.
Khalilzad has also made statements critical of cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, whose militia battled U.S. troops in 2004 and whose political party now holds the most seats in the Iraqi parliament and backs Jaafari's nomination. Al-Maliki says that provoking Sadr could lead to more fighting, reversing efforts by all sides to convince the cleric to participate in the political process.
Khalilzad wants more fighting with the Jaish al-Mahdi. This is not good for our government now. It is better for Muqtada al-Sadr and the Sadr movement to not be outside politics. Khalilzad does not understand this.
But Sadr appears to be leaning toward using political rather than military leverage to strike back at Khalilzad and Shiites increasingly seen as U.S. allies. At Friday prayers in Sadr City, worshippers chanted "No, no" to America, and Mohammed Al-Attab Tabai'i, an aide to Sadr, reiterated the cleric's call to his followers to ignore U.S. provocations and continue participating in politics.
Syed Muttada is now in the government. You must go back to the political office and wait. America will be punished by God in the future.
On Sunday, Condoleezza Rice and Jack Straw visited Baghdad in an attempt to put pressure on leaders to form a government, which cannot be done until a prime minister is selected. But so far, no decision has been made. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
Iran remains defiant this week over calls by the UN Security Council to cease its uranium enrichment program, which the UN fears is a precursor to the country developing nuclear weapons. FSRN's Cinnamon Napard reports from Berlin, where talks with permanent Security Council members of Russia, China, France, the UK, and the US, plus Germany, failed to resolve just what to do if Iran does not comply with the 30-day deadline.
The face-off between Iran and the E5 is certainly troubling but unsurprising given the West's track record of negotiating with the Middle East. Thomas Henschel, director of the European Council of Governance in Berlin.
I think we've done a lot of things wrong in the past. We had not given them the respect they need. If we would invest a fraction of what we are investing into weapons and forces, like in the Iraq war, into this alternative dispute resolution programs and to understand them, we would have been much further in development and dialogue with the Arabic world.
Adding to the situation is the criticism from people such as Thomas Henschel that the UN Security Council is outdated and must be reformed in order to adequately deal with the problems and issues of today. The Security Council's strength has also been undermined by its members' actions, for example, the US.
When they had a fear of terror, they went unilateral. Now that the US and the others need the dialogue with the other states in order to deal with Iran, Russia and China say, why should we do so? I think what it shows is that you cannot have a dialogue-oriented security policy just when it is in your interest. You have to do it always, as a form of an international culture of security policy.
Further undermining the efficacy of the Security Council's resolutions are inconsistencies between the treatment of countries who have access to nuclear-powered weapons. Stephen Szabo, Professor of European Studies at the Hertie School of Governance in Berlin, says that the United States finds Iran more threatening than India, who also has a nuclear program. However, it's Iran's fear of the US that is a significant motivating factor in its nuclear development program.
It's afraid of the United States. The United States has threatened Iran a number of times. It's got troops on the Iranian border. Iran is also facing nuclear states in Pakistan, Israel, and India. So also Russia is on their border too. So they see this as a guarantee that the U.S. or other countries won't invade them because they have nuclear weapons. But beyond that, I think they would also like to become a dominant power in the region.
With this delicate situation unfolding and fears for the region following Iran's inflammatory comments regarding the destruction of Israel last October, the situation remains tense for diplomatic negotiations, especially as Iran has chosen to exercise its military muscle by testing missiles in the Persian Gulf today. For Free Speech Radio News in Berlin, I'm Cinnamon Nippard.
Farm workers, organized by the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, rallied outside the largest McDonald's in Chicago this weekend, calling for fair wages and just working conditions for the people who pick the tomatoes used by the fast food giant. Shannon Heffernan reports from Chicago, where Lucas Benitez explains a typical workday.
And you go out and looking for work around 5 o'clock in the morning. Are you working the whole day? Sometimes it's 10, 12 hours a day. And you come back to home around 8 o'clock. If you pick 125 buckets, or you make it $50. And this represents 2 tons of tomatoes.
Every day, workers like Lucas Benitez pick tomatoes for the same wages as farm workers received in 1978. In Florida, these farm workers are not legally entitled to overtime wages or to the right to organize. At night, these workers are often overcharged for housing near the fields. Melanie Gonzalez of the Student Farmworkers Alliance.
Prelude, for example, charges $1,200 a month. And so you think, well, if a worker is coming home with about $250 a week, how are they paying that? Well, it's a trailer that's maybe made for 4 or 5 people, but there's about 15, 16 people living in that trailer.
Gonzalez says that these sweatshop conditions have paved the way for even more severe human rights violations.
In the extreme conditions, you have cases of modern-day slavery. And when we say slavery, we're not using the term to exaggerate the conditions. We're talking about a type of slavery that the Department of Justice and the FBI have said this is modern-day slavery. These are workers that are held against their will, forced to work in isolated labor camps where they often cannot receive any visits, they cannot leave. They're guarded 24 hours a day. They're threatened, sometimes physically abused.
The Coalition of Immokalee Workers has identified fast food restaurants as major purchasers of Florida tomatoes. In response to a 4-year boycott led by Immokalee workers, Taco Bell recently agreed to pay 1 more cent per pound for tomatoes. Workers are now touring the country, asking the McDonald's to do the same. They stopped in Chicago to deliver their message in front of McDonald's flagship store.
My name is Francesca Cortez, and I've been a member of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers for nearly 6 years. I've heard about the history of the agricultural industry and how it was first slaves that worked the fields, and then it was poor whites, and now it's us, mostly poor Latino immigrants.
When they buy the tomatoes or when they buy the hamburger, sometimes it's a cheap price for the hamburgers, but somebody pay, we pay for this cheap price for this food.
Representatives from the Immokalee workers called the tour and rally a success and said that they were confident the continued public pressure would force McDonald's to join Taco Bell in paying 1 more cent per pound of tomatoes. This move would double the wages of all the farm workers in Immokalee. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shannon Heffernan.
Thousands marched in New Orleans on Saturday to protest disenfranchisement of displaced voters and to call for a delay of the April 22 elections. This weekend's rally included national black political and media figures and is the latest development in a growing struggle to assure equal access to voting for the New Orleans diaspora. FSRN's Christian Roseland has more.
We cannot fight wars for democracy around the world and undermine democracy at home, and so we shall fight, and we will prevail.
After a 3-hour rally Saturday morning, Jesse Jackson led a march of thousands across the Mississippi River Bridge in New Orleans. Walking alongside Jackson was the Reverend Al Sharpton and a number of other high-profile black leaders, as well as New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin. Among those marching behind were many bused in from out of state to attend this event, including displaced New Orleanians. March participant Pamela Mahogany of New Orleans says she sees this march as part of an historical process.
A long time ago, we didn't have the right to vote, and people fought for us to have the right to vote. And I think it's very important that black people exercise their right to vote, because if we don't vote, then we're saying continue to do to us whatever you want.
A central demand of March organizers is the delay of the April 22nd elections in New Orleans until better provisions for evacuee voters are made. Jackson and other organizers say that the election in its current form does not comply with the Voting Rights Act of 1965, a landmark civil rights law to protect minority voters.
Those we defeated 40 years ago have never given up on trying to take it back. So we demand the Voting Rights Act be enforced.
Early in March, Louisiana State Senator Cleo Fields of Baton Rouge publicly asked the Department of Justice not to certify the April 22nd election, saying that among other problems, FEMA's refusal to allow candidates access to their list of addresses was a violation of the Voting Rights Act. Jennifer Merzak of the Louisiana Secretary of State's office declined to comment on the impact of FEMA's refusal to release these addresses to FSRN in a phone interview, stating that the matter was between FEMA and Senator Fields. Merzak says that the Secretary of State has done everything in its power to reach out to displaced voters, including setting up satellite voting stations in 10 Louisiana parishes, but admits that with hundreds of thousands of displaced voters, the circumstances of this election are absolutely unprecedented. However, official answers were inadequate for many on Saturday, like Chuck Mills of the national anti-racist group, the People's Institute.
I can only speculate because I don't really know anybody in Louisiana power structure, but I think there certainly is a racial dimension whether they intend for it to be or not. And you know, it's just as bad as if it was really intentional.
For FSRN, I'm Christian Roseland.
An annual Native American Sacred Run themed Running for Peace and Mother Earth added a third goal this year for hurricane recovery. Runners and walkers took a detour of almost 1,000 miles from their normal cross-country route to visit the Houma tribal nation in the bayous of southern Louisiana. There, they learned about the devastation caused by Hurricanes Katrina and Rita and about the role of the oil and gas industry in the disenfranchisement of the native people. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports from Golden Meadow, Louisiana.
While the runners took the day off to repair the roofs of some hurricane-damaged homes, Sacred Run founder and American Indian Movement leader Dennis Banks said a prayer before leading a 5-mile walk through a few small native communities. With a population of 15,000, the Houma is the largest Indian tribe in Louisiana. Their ancestral land of bayous, rich in shrimp and other seafood, is now dotted with thousands of oil and gas rigs. The industry's canals crisscross the fragile ecosystem and promote saltwater intrusion, contributing to the annual loss of 25 square miles of land into the Gulf of Mexico, the largest land loss in the world. But since the tribe is not federally recognized, despite a 21-year effort, the Houma people get no financial benefit from this massive industrial production. Banks said he'd like to help change that.
I would like to add the efforts of the Houma Nation to wherever we go, and we go many places. We'll be in Washington on April 22nd, and I'm going to mention the Houma Nation. I'm going to mention the lack of federal recognition. I also know why some of the reasons why you're being denied that federal recognition because of the location where you're at, the natural resources that are here. Yeah. They think it belongs to them.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
When we know that it belongs to the Houma Nation.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why they're saying no. Yeah. You know, oil industry speaks.
The Sacred Run began as the longest walk in 1978 with Native runners and their supporters running from San Francisco to Washington, D.C. Each day, runners are dropped in different locations so that by the end, the whole route has been covered by at least one runner. The overarching theme of every run is all life is sacred. As they meet people along the route, runners and walkers talk about the need to protect sacred sites and burial sites and the need for clean air, water, and soil. The need to restore the earth and its surroundings was critical in southern Louisiana even before last year's hurricane double whammy, but is even more so now. Brenda Dardar-Robichaud, principal chief of the United Houma Nation, said she was honored by the Sacred Run's visit and support for her people's cause.
I think it's going to be still an uphill battle trying to gain this federal recognition. We're going to continue the fight, and I'd be willing to open up a dialogue with Dennis to find out exactly his ideas of how we should proceed with our federal recognition process.
For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in the Houma Nation of southern Louisiana.
The Venezuelan Association of Alternative Community and Free Media, which encompasses more than 100 licensed and unlicensed community radio stations and brings together other types of alternative media, such as mural painters, bloggers, and performance artists, held its fifth annual conference in Valencia, Venezuela, this weekend. Patrick Engstrom-Poor reports from Venezuela, where community media is rapidly developing.
According to the Venezuelan Ministry of Information, almost 200 non-commercial radio stations are licensed by Conatel, Venezuelan's version of the FCC. More than 300 are currently waiting for licenses, and some of these are transmitting anyway. Quite a few have less than 5 years on the air. Some say that the administration of Hugo Chavez is limiting free speech, but the ability of the average Venezuelan to access broadcast media has expanded rapidly during his administration. AMCLA is one of the larger alternative media networks. Just over 5 years old, it counts some of the most active community radio stations in the country as its members. More than 300 people from at least 30 stations from all over the country attended this weekend's conference. They discussed projects which could rapidly change the control and distribution of information in a media-polarized environment where private mass media rails against the government, the state-owned networks always show the government's best side, and independent voices are clamoring to be heard. Maria Hernandez is a volunteer in a radio station in north central Venezuela. She explains the importance of this conference for her station. Right now, we are not producing news, but that's the reason we're here, because we want to come to agreement on how to deliver the news from our own communities to other communities in Venezuela. Today, we are in the process of creating news, including this national community news service. Another workshop detailed the logistics of mass-producing low-power transmitters to generate income and democratize access to the airwaves. Carlos Acosta, of the station Pueblo Nuevo in Mérida, was one of the engineers leading the workshop. We must achieve technological independence, and we should start to construct for ourselves everything down to the smallest part of the transmitter, how to make a transmitter, to start to make all of the pieces here in the country, and given that, construct the rest from there. Above all, to have the possibility of offering transmitters to all of America, as much in the United States as in the rest of Latin America.
Para toda la América, tanto Estados Unidos como en la América Latina.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Patrick Engström-Poor from Valencia, Venezuela.
From his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, Free Speech Radio News correspondent Mumia Abu-Jamal brings us this commentary.
From warrior to writer, Cherno Imba's journey. Imagine, if you can, what you were doing when you were 12 years old. Cherno Alpha Imba, a 27-year-old West African journalist, can't forget. That's because Cherno was one of 15,000 child soldiers fighting a dreadful, bloody civil war in Sierra Leone. The war, waged by the brutal revolutionary United Front, wreaked havoc upon the country throughout the 1990s. When the people demanded and fought for peace, Cherno left the army. And when he learned that the RUF-led regime was a force for national repression instead of liberation, he became increasingly politically active as an organizer against the military junta and as a journalist. Working as a pro-democracy and socialist agitator and writer, Cherno Imba worked tirelessly to bring an end to the regime and for the restoration of civilian rule. Today, he speaks bitingly of the betrayal of his youth and much of post-colonial Africa, as he did at a recent speech in London, saying, "We lived through violence, grew in it, and tasted its painful fruits. We are witnesses and victims of the diabolic activities of insincere individuals who have manipulated our appalling conditions to fulfill their opportunistic desires, whilst at the same time satisfying the needs of the imperialist countries who commissioned them." In exile from Sierra Leone for his political and journalistic activities, Cherno Imba found repression in many other West African countries, instigated by governments which sold their souls to Western corporate neocolonial interests. While in Guinea, he helped form the Young Writers Association, an association of journalists from Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. In 2001, he was arrested and imprisoned on charges of espionage and sedition. After his release, the regime in Guinea promptly banned the Young Writers Association and the newspaper put out by the YWA, the nation's newspaper. Today, Cherno Imba is touring the U.S. to try to teach folks about the ruinous diamond wars in West Africa, the horrors of childhood war, and the necessity to build the global struggle for African liberation from Western imperialism and their neocolonial puppets. Today, we all have much to learn from Cherno Alpha Imba. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.